today on Against the Grain. In a California prison, domestic violence survivors who killed their abusers in self-defense practiced a politics of mutual care and resistance. I'm CS. We'll revisit a conversation with the scholar and writer Rachel Leah Klein, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Until 1990, the California Institution for Women was the largest women's prison in the world. Among the people confined there are domestic violence survivors who killed in self-defense. The way in which many of them organized behind bars, how they practiced self-care and mutual aid, and took collective political action has been the focus of Rachel Leah Klein's research. The context, which you'll hear about, is important. A massive prison-building project, tough-on-crime rhetoric and legislation, rampant abuse and neglect in overcrowded prisons, and a legal system callous to the plight of criminalized survivors. In the face of all this, a group of women who endured domestic violence and then state violence found each other, worked to change the system, and tried to secure their freedom. Rachel Leah Klein is a doctoral student at USC in the Department of American Studies and Ethnicity. Her article, Surviving Domestic and State Violence, Women's Prison Organizing and the Gendered Politics of Solidarity, appears in the journal Gender and History. When Rachel and I connected recently, she said this about the woman who founded the group Convicted Women Against Abuse.
Brenda Klubein was convicted and sentenced to life for fatally defending herself against her abusive husband. He was a retired police officer, so as you can imagine, he had not only the protection that the state offers male abusers, but the whole kind of police infrastructure. Brenda had tried to report his abuse many times. She sought counseling. She sought domestic violence shelters, restraining orders, none of which diminished his violence against her. And one final night, she finally fought back, and he ended up dying from her self-defense. And she was sentenced to 15 years to life at the California Institution for Women, which is the oldest state prison for women in California, located at about an hour, 50 miles from Los Angeles.
What's her experience initially, just in terms of her comfort level? Obviously very difficult to be comfortable behind bars, and her sense of ability to connect with other people, including about what she did, to her abusive spouse.
So like, you know, all incarcerated people who go to prison, incarceration is incredibly traumatic and isolating and harmful. And so not only was she dealing with the trauma of what she survived, she was a mother separated from her young son. She was trying to adjust to the life in prison. And she really thought that her experience as a survivor of domestic violence was really unique. And she told me a story about being in the chow hall or the kind of cafeteria where people eat and hearing two women kind of discussing their own cases about being convicted for defending themselves against domestic violence. And she had assumed that they were talking about her because she didn't realize that there were hundreds or more women in the California Institution for Women and across, you know, in prisons across the country that were convicted for the very same acts. And she approached them and asked if they were talking about her case, and they said no, that they were talking about their own. And that really clued her in that there was this much larger dynamic of women who had survived often decades of violence, intimate partner violence, family violence, and had been convicted for and sentenced often to life for defending themselves. And so she, it kind of sparked her idea to start this group, which she named Convicted Women Against Abuse. And she was actually really surprised that the prison, given how many women were incarcerated for defending themselves, did not have a kind of group that dealt with this kind of unique trauma, what I call this kind of double violence of first surviving domestic violence on the outside and then kind of navigating state violence inside prison.
And by state violence within prison, you are talking about efforts to intimidate, repress, make life difficult for incarcerated people?
I think of state violence as the entire kind of criminal legal or prison system as a whole. Incarceration is state violence in my mind. By separating people from their families and communities is state violence. By creating conditions in prison like medical neglect, sexual violence from guards and other staff members, not providing people with the basic necessities that they need to survive, physical violence, intimidation, you know, confiscating people's things, creating kind of bogus disciplinary infractions, and all kind of forms of intimidation. But to me, by nature, incarceration itself is state violence. So that's what I mean by state violence, a kind of very broad term to encompass what incarceration is at its core.
So Brenda Klubein, she, as you said, wanted to create some sort of support group. And she went to the authorities to try and do that. How did they respond?
They were very resistant. They did not support the effort. She had to file kind of rounds of grievances, which is, you know, this internal grievance process where you have to file petitions and go through appeals and go through a waiting process, which took about 3 years for them to finally approve the group.
The first meeting, as I understand it, of Convicted Women Against Abuse occurred in May 1989, again at this California Institution for Women prison. 10 women showed up. What did she tell them? What information did she present?
So from what Brenda told me, she really wanted to kind of inspire a group discussion, but people were really struggling to speak up in that moment, right? These people had been blamed and shamed and condemned, often first by family members or partners, then by the criminal legal system, and then the prison system, that this was their fault, that they had done something wrong. And so Brenda took that first meeting to really turn that all on its head, tell them about her own story of survival, about conviction, and that just because the law said that they were so-called killers or worse, that it wasn't true, that they were survivors, that they had a right to defend themselves, that they had a right to safety. And it was a really powerful message in this context, in the late 80s, hyper-criminalization, mass punishment and incarceration, that the law was wrong, that the prison system was wrong. And that was a really powerful moment for people to kind of be more vulnerable and start sharing their own stories and connecting over their shared stories.
In this article, you bring up a number of fellow members of this group. Can you tell us about one other member, how she ended up in prison, and what happened when she started going to the CWAA Convicted Women Against Abuse meetings?
Yes, yeah, so another really kind of founding member who was there from the very beginning was Susan Bustamante, a Latina mother from East LA, who was also convicted in the 1980s for the death of her husband, who was her abuser. She did not actually kill her husband. She wasn't even present when his death took place, but her brother did commit the murder against him, and she was convicted for his death. Her brother actually died before she was convicted, and so she was the only person that went to prison for his death. And Susan is an incredible organizer, but at that time when she first went to prison, like Brenda, was just reeling from this rapid transformation of her life. She had two young kids, was separated from her family, and she also didn't necessarily recognize herself as a survivor or as a battered woman as Brenda did, because she felt like her story didn't conform to whatever associations the larger public kind of deemed about what a battered woman looked like. For example, medical records that offered proof, or restraining orders or police reports, which certainly Susan can now recognize, as many battered women, does not diminish a person's violence just because someone does not go down those traditional institutional routes that often don't do anything anyways. But it's to say that it took some convincing by Brenda that she was a survivor. And in those meetings, she began to recognize that those things didn't matter about, you know, a hospital record or a police record. But what mattered was her experience. What mattered is that she survived violence. And what mattered was that she was convicted for surviving violence.
So a sort of community was formed behind bars. This group had weekly meetings beginning in 1989. You write that it became the first domestic violence support group in a California prison. Why was the formation of community among incarcerated people important? How does that push back against institutional norms that might try to prevent community from forming, say, among incarcerated people?
Yeah, it's a really important question. And one of the things I found so remarkable about this group, you know, the whole prison system is really meant to sow division and distrust between incarcerated people to kind of prevent forms of collectivity and collective action. And I would argue that the law does the same. They do this by, again, sowing conflict, by kind of instituting that people don't discuss their so-called crimes. They do this by requiring this kind of exclusive self-blame, and that's from prison officials, that's from court officials, and certainly from parole officials. That require this complete narrative that is devoid of any context and is only about one's own actions, that does not at all match up with the way the world works or how people exist relationally and against structures. You know, and another way the prison really sows conflict is through kind of models and rationales of scarcity, right? That resource are going to someone or this group of people, therefore there are none for here. And so really kind of building conflict through scarcity, through kind of individualism, all things that really hurt the ability of incarcerated people to come together. And so I see it as the act of meeting, the act of coming together in this very hostile environment as an important anti-carceral political formation. And the other way that I think it's really important is, again, that the prison really produces this condition of neglect. People are separated from their loved ones and communities and need community and social relations. People are deprived of basic necessities, food, literally enough food so you will not go hungry, medical care, reproductive gynecological care, mental health care. And so, again, all these women, these survivors of domestic violence who were mostly convicted of life sentences, were traumatized from what they had survived, were separated from their families, were traumatized by prison. And by coming together, they were able to begin healing together, to build solidarity, and ultimately build a kind of collective political movement.
Rachel Leah Klein is my guest. She is a doctoral student at USC in the Department of American Studies and Ethnicity. We are talking about an article she wrote titled Surviving Domestic and State Violence, Women's Prison Organizing and the Gendered Politics of Solidarity. It appears in the journal Gender and History. We have a link to that article, which is open access, on our website, againstthegrain.org. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Let's set some context, as you do in your article, for what was going on with Brenda, with Susan, with this new support group behind bars. Crime rates turned downward after 1980, yet California pursued a massive prison-building project during the 80s and 90s. How did authorities propose to fill prison beds, and what did women as targets of incarceration have to do with this prison building and prison filling project?
So there's been a lot of scholars who have written really excellent work on this, you know, the kind of field-defining work of people like Ruth Wilson Gilmore and Golden Gulag really has tracked the ways that carceral expansion happened in California, how California really led the nation in mass incarceration and states kind of followed. You know, prior to 1987, the California Institution for Women, which is the prison that I am talking about, was the only state prison for women in California. Over the next 8 years, from 1987 to 1995, California opened three additional prisons, including two massive prisons in the Central Valley, the Central California Women's Facility, and the Valley State Prison for Women, which were each constructed at over double the size of the California Institution for Women and built directly across the street from one another. Despite this prison building project, all four of the women's prisons were massively overcrowded by the 1990s and produced horrific conditions of neglect and violence against incarcerated people. And it is part of a larger story of kind of California's carceral turn and the nation's carceral turn that really happened from the late 1970s onward. And this happened by criminalizing social problems like drug addiction, poverty, unemployment, criminalizing people and communities, particularly Black and Latinx communities, the kind of creation of these gang databases, and this war on gangs that very much happened at a very intense pace in California. The creation of these mandatory minimum sentences, which really extended significantly the time that people spent in prison. The kind of escalation of life sentences, three strikes, right, which is a life sentence for three felony convictions. And this project of prison construction and mass criminalization was obviously very connected with neoliberal restructuring. And so it speaks to why were people, why was there such a large unemployment rate, and the changing nature of labor, the changing nature of state support for especially single mothers and families, and widening inequality in the state. And so, right at the same time that mass incarceration and criminalization was ramping up, the state was divesting and shrinking resources for poor and working class people, effectively abandoning them and then removing them from their communities into prisons. And women really experienced the brunt of the kind of welfare demonization that was happening in the 80s and 90s, kind of most famously with you know, Bill Clinton's promise to end welfare, which he did in 1996. And so families were really struggling, and especially single mothers were really struggling to take care of their families.
Let's talk about the anti-domestic violence movement in the U.S. How did it arise, and what did that movement look like in the 60s and 70s?
So the anti-domestic violence movement, which was also part of the kind of, or included the kind of anti-rape movement, really emerged out of the women's movement of the 60s and 70s, and examined and tried to challenge and work against the crisis of gender-based violence and violence against women. And these early organizers really recognized that gender-based violence was an outgrowth of patriarchy, of misogyny, of a sexist society. And so they had a systematic analysis. And it started off very grassroots. You know, there weren't battered women shelters or hotlines. And so they created these kind of community networks of safety and support. And that was the early formation, just kind of building networks, trying to offer kind of community safety and small scale support, which then became scaled up with institutionalization over the 70s and 80s. But what happens with this kind of institutionalization and even incorporation into the state is gender violence then becomes, and especially by the 90s, kind of whittled down from this problem of patriarchy to a criminal problem that can be solved with more arrests, more prosecution, and more incarceration.
And were feminists, were activists, were many of them rooting for this greater police control and targeting of people in their households who were committing domestic violence, who were committing abuse?
Some mainstream, especially white feminists, were, again, whose families were not marked or vulnerable by the same systems and institutions of state racism, like policing and incarceration, that families of color or immigrant families, and especially Black families, were experiencing. So they did, in the mainstream kind of feminist anti-violence movement, they did end up championing kind of criminalization as a solution. Although there were many women and many cohorts of the anti-violence movement that were very critical, reluctant, and spoke out against it.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm joined by Rachel Leah Klein, a PhD candidate at the University of Southern California, where she studies mass incarceration and the disruption of motherhood, as well as the overlap between criminal justice and culture. She was formerly a staff writer at Salon, where she wrote about culture, race, feminism, and criminal justice. And she penned an article that just appeared in the journal Gender and History. It's titled Surviving Domestic and State Violence: Women's Prison Organizing and the Gendered Politics of Solidarity. And returning to this group, Convicted Women Against Abuse, let's talk more about their activities within kind of the context of what you've been describing. At one point, Brenda, the founder of CWAA, she assigned her fellow members the task of writing a letter to their abuser. What was the purpose of this?
There were, I think, several purposes of this. One is that most of these women, and again, the women in CWAA, they all did not have identical kind of convictions or situations, but all of them had abusers and that they had survived. But by nature of incarceration, they were unable to communicate, or some of them were killed. And so this was a way to have communication and closure, to kind of say things that they maybe never got to say. They got to stand up for themselves. Some of them may have used the letters to take whatever forms of accountability they felt like were necessary. But to describe the situation in their own terms, which is something that the criminal legal system denied them. And so it was a very powerful process, and she gave them several weeks to complete it.
And once these letters were written, then what happened?
So she created this kind of ceremony, this ceremony of healing and closure and solidarity among the women. They had a trash can, and each woman placed her letter in this trash can. And according to Brenda, they did this outside, they were able to light this trash can on fire and physically and symbolically burn these letters.
And what was the purpose of that, and how did it make the women feel?
I think the purpose, you know, was closure, was healing, was trying to move on from this trauma and violence so they could heal. And I think it was also symbolic, you know, releasing these women from feelings of shame and blame that their abusers and the criminal legal system both imparted on them. And yeah, just a kind of cathartic release is what Brenda described to me. And it was a very emotional experience. She said everyone was crying.
And this assignment and the ritual, this is part of what you describe as the self-care, the collective care work that the group did, the mutual aid, the nurturing of each other, the supporting of each other. And then you write that the group maybe took another step, not a more important step, but took a step in another direction. In 1990, the group produced, again, this is Convicted Women Against Abuse, they produced a 48-page booklet. Tell us about its contents and who the booklet was distributed to.
Yeah, so Brenda first told me about this booklet when I interviewed her for this article, and I was actually able to find the full booklet in the State Archives in Sacramento, and it's this incredibly rich and powerful text. It features poetry and artwork. It features kind of introductory framing remarks from Brenda. It features various kind of mainstream feminist theories and rationales about battered women and victimization. But most importantly, and most thoroughly, what the bulk of the book is the women of CWAA kind of offering their own testimony about themselves, about what they had survived, about the power of their group. And many of them really questioning the kind of validity of their criminalization and incarceration and advocating for change. And Brenda, through donations, was able to put the book together and distribute it and send it to lawmakers across the state.
They sent the booklet to lawmakers. Did they get a response?
They did. So Brenda described to me after she distributed the booklet being called into a prison official's office and hearing from a legislator on the phone who had received the booklet and, you know, according to Brenda, was very moved by the booklet and wanted to conduct a hearing at the prison to hear about the plight and the experiences of battered women in prison.
And this hearing was held at the prison. There were a number of California state lawmakers there. It lasted, I understand, 4 hours. How many women testified before this legislative body, and what was the result?
So 8 women testified at this hearing, including Brenda, and they really described in detail their experiences and their struggles of intimate partner violence or family violence to these lawmakers. One woman who testified had survived 50 years of spousal abuse before defending herself. And the lawmakers and the media were really impacted by this hearing. Jackie Speier, who was head of the Women's Caucus, she thought that none of the women who spoke deserved, you know, 15-year to life sentences or even to maybe even be in prison at all. And prior to this hearing, there was already this momentum in the state to pass legislation that would allow battered women's syndrome evidence to go into law, which is this psychological theory from psychologist Lenore Walker, who kind of appropriated this theory of learned helplessness and some other factors to really kind of explain why battered women stay in abusive relationships. And many scholars, activists, academics, etc., critique this theory because it really puts the onus, number one, on the victims, right? It's not called batterer syndrome, but battered woman syndrome. And it's kind of used to psychologically analyze the actions of survivors or of victims in this kind of very monolithic, passive way. You know, to her credit, I think she was really battling against this dominant narrative of especially men, prosecutors, lawmakers, men's rights activists who really rallied against it of, you know, why won't battered women just leave? Which is, you know, a pretty extraordinary question to ask anytime in a society of patriarchy, but especially under neoliberal restructuring, where there is very little support for, you know, single mothers trying to leave, not enough battered women shelters, not really any places of refuge or safety for people to go. Never mind the kind of other logistical or financial or emotional constraints that women face. So, you know, in a short sense, it's just a victim blaming kind of question.
Right. And this was an important argument to counter, right? That the argument goes that battered women have other choices than to kill their abusers, to fatally defend themselves against abuse. And what you're saying is that there are so many reasons why that's not an option, that women wouldn't see an alternative such as leaving the relationship as viable, as feasible, as doable.
Exactly. And I think ultimately it asks the wrong question. You know, the better question is, why is gender violence so pervasive in our society, right? And that requires very different kind of avenues of inquiry and very different responses than why don't battered women leave their relationships.
That's the voice of Rachel Leah Klein. She is a doctoral student at USC in the Department of American Studies and Ethnicity, founder of the hip-hop blog and YouTube channel Come Home With Me. She organizes with the California Coalition for Women Prisoners, a grassroots prison abolitionist organization, and she volunteers with USC's Prison Education Project. The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. I guess if one were cynical, one would say, well, the people who believe that you should throw women like Brenda and Susan behind bars for life, that they are worried that women will use this to target men and therefore not give men the kind of freedom they have in many cases to treat women, to treat their spouses, to treat their partners and lovers any way they want.
That it's interesting because that was very much a kind of discourse at this time that Brenda and Susan and the women of CWAA and all kind of convicted survivors were up against. What kind of prosecutors and so-called men's rights activists kind of used was that like battered women syndrome or any kind of defense or justice for battered women who defended themselves gave them license to kill. You know, that men were going to become vulnerable and that their lives were going to be degraded because of this, which is, you know, tells us in one ways how little has changed, but also a completely divorced from any kind of social reality of what gender-based violence in a kind of intimate partner sense, and also how gender really structures criminalization and incarceration. And so a lot of the women of CWA, they began to learn that women on average face longer sentences than men, and especially women who kill their partners in self-defense face much longer sentences than men who do that. Even though men are much more likely to kill and harm their partners than women are. And so CWAA and many of their allies and advocates in this kind of movement for battered women in prison, they really countered that, you know, not reckoning with the need for women to be able to defend themselves, since there weren't structural interventions or places of safety, didn't give battered women license to kill their spouses. It gave batterers license to kill them.
Did the women you interviewed, the women who were part of Convicted Women Against Abuse, did they tell you anything about their reaction in court when they were convicted of an act that they thought was absolutely necessary in order to protect their lives and quite possibly the lives of their offspring?
They didn't describe necessarily their reactions. What they did tell me over and over again is that they were barred or disallowed from bringing any of their history of survival into their trials. So their lawyers, their case could not mention any of their experiences or instances of domestic violence that provided the critical context for their final action of self-defense. And so that's what the battered women syndrome law kind of changed, and why they felt like it may have helped them, even though it was so problematic in its kind of conception. But that really shocked them, you know, hearing from their lawyers or from the judges, you know, that their husbands weren't on trial. They were. So they weren't allowed to talk about what they had experienced. That was 1980s criminal legal system that completely disallowed them from telling their full stories.
So that was certainly a very overtly political activity to produce a booklet to circulated to lawmakers, culminating, resulting in a hearing in the prison. Another political effort in the conventional sense, because I get the sense your argument is that the collective care done by and among these women in prison was a political act, and you can certainly respond to that as well. But another sort of more conventional political strategy that they pursued was to pursue clemency. So imprisoned survivors of domestic violence mobilized in a number of locations around the U.S. in an effort to gain clemency. Talk about some of those efforts and what happened specifically with Convicted Women Against Abuse in California.
Yeah, so this CWAA's clemency effort is one of the main components of the article, and what I believe is a direct outgrowth of their care work, as you mentioned, was political and created the conditions for solidarity that inspired them to file one clemency petition for all the nearly three dozen members. And this very much was inspired by clemency organizing that was happening all across the country. There were successful efforts in the early 90s in Ohio, where a Democratic governor granted clemency to 25 incarcerated survivors convicted of killing their partners. Then 2 months later, in 91, the Maryland Democratic governor commuted the sentences of 8 women. And so that really built this momentum that clemency and freedom for battered women in prison was possible. And you saw these clemency movements sprout up in California through CWAA, in Florida, in New York, in Massachusetts, all over the country. And some of these clemency efforts were kind of especially instigated and immobilized by outside activists, where CWAA was really self-organized. And so their initial move, and they did this before they kind of embarked on their battered women syndrome advocacy or kind of legal lobbying, they filed one petition for all 34 members of CWA at that time in 1990.
And this petition for clemency, was directed at California Governor Pete Wilson?
Directed at very conservative Republican Governor Wilson.
And Wilson actually took a number of years, maybe a couple of years, to rule on the petition. What did he decide to do?
Well, first, I think it's important to note that Wilson completely rejected the kind of format of a collective clemency petition and required the women to file individual clemency petitions. And that really, I think, supports what I was saying of how the prison system with the law as a whole really diminishes collectivity and collective action, right? That he would not even accept a clemency petition in this collective form, even though the women had been organizing and recognized their freedom as very much interconnected. And he kind of sat on these petitions for years. And then in 1993, he finally ruled on the clemency petitions. Again, these were 34 petitions, and he effectively granted two, but even that was kind of convoluted in that he granted relief based on battered women syndrome to just one woman, but instead of immediately releasing her, he just reduced her sentence, which meant she could go up to parole sooner, but she ended up staying in prison for a number of years further. And he did end up releasing one very elderly woman. But he made sure to say that it's not because he felt like she was a victim of domestic violence and unjustly incarcerated, but because she was of older age and was in declining health. And he ended up denying Brenda Klubein and several other petitions. And for the vast majority of the petitions, he just ignored them and didn't respond to them.
I'm reading here that, Wilson reduced the sentence of Brenda Aris from 15 years to life to 12 years to life. So this is not a dramatic reduction in the sentence. And she didn't see it as, you write that she didn't see it as significant at all. The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. Rachel Leah Klein joins us. We have a link to her website on our website, againstthegrain.org. And we're talking about an article she wrote titled Surviving Domestic and State Violence, Women's Prison Organizing and the Gendered Politics of Solidarity. The article appears in an issue of the journal Gender and History called Engendering Carcerality. And again, it's open access, and we have a link to that article on our website. Another chapter in the adventure that was and kind of is convicted women against abuses ongoing project, ongoing activism, occurred with a passage of Senate Bill 799 in California. It became law in 2001. What did SB 799 allow battered women to do, and what did CWAA do in response?
So yeah, this was the product of CWAA's organizing, and again, these kind of inside-outside networks and relationships that they had been developing, and this kind of larger clemency movement and justice for incarcerated battered women that people had been organizing around for more than 10 years at that point. And SB 799 amended the penal code, and it allowed battered women in prison who were convicted of murder before 1992 who did not have their abuse presented at trial, which was Brenda, which was Susan, which was many of these women who were convicted in the 80s, to file a habeas petition for their freedom. And so they could petition on the grounds that if domestic violence had been brought into their trials, they may have had a different outcome. The problem with this bill is that there was no kind of financial resources or legal resources to assist incarcerated women who qualify to file these petitions. And so community groups and legal organizations and lawyers formed what they called the Habeas Project to represent incarcerated survivors, right? Because this took really enormous pro bono work to achieve freedom and justice for some of these women. And it is through this habeas effort that Brenda ultimately was freed from prison in 2008 after more than 25 years inside. Some other CWAA women were also freed through this habeas project and this habeas petition, though many women ended up spending much longer in prison, like Susan, who wasn't released from prison until 2018, after 31 years inside.
What about today? Does California still criminalize domestic violence survivors who kill their abusers in self-defense?
Absolutely. It continues to be a cruel and horrific form of criminalization and violence against survivors who have already survived so much. I cite in the article, I found a kind of study that estimated that 70 to 80% of incarcerated women were survivors of violence. I would say that is a very low conservative estimate, just based on my experience in organizing spaces in the last 5 years. I have not met a single currently or formerly incarcerated person who is not a survivor of some type of interpersonal violence. So that kind of intersection of interpersonal violence and state violence or carceral violence very much continues. The UC Sentencing Project, which is out of UCLA, just published this study in 2023 called Maximizing Time, Maximizing Punishment: The Lived Experiences of Long-Term Sentences in California Women's Prisons. And they really illustrate that in the present, incarcerated people continue to go unrecognized as victims and survivors. That the criminal legal system and the prison system exacerbate people's traumas. And of course, that these long sentences have lifelong, multi-generational impacts. I think another recent development is that there has been rampant systematic sexual violence from prison staff at FCI Dublin, which was the federal women's prison in the Bay Area. Survivors there organized and connected with activists and filed a class action lawsuit. And things have been rapidly changing, but warden and other staff members have, faced termination and criminalization for their violence against women and other people in FCI Dublin. And a judge ruled recently that a kind of special master has to oversee it. And rather than kind of rectifying any of this harm or releasing survivors as survivors and community organizers called for, the Federal Bureau of Prisons opted to abruptly close the prison and disperse all those people in that prison to federal prisons all over the country. So I think these two examples really highlight the current plight, again, that the criminal legal system absolutely continues to criminalize people for surviving violence, and that the prison system itself exacerbates and produces gender-based violence.
Rachel, you work with a prison abolitionist organization. How important are incarcerated domestic violence survivors to efforts to abolish prisons?
I think they are absolutely central. I think, again, the idea that prisons criminalize people for surviving violence and produce violence against women and queer people and all people in its kind of hold is an important reason to understand the urgency and why we need to abolish prisons. I think in another sense, the California Coalition for Women Prisoners, which is the prison abolitionist group I'm very fortunate to be a part of, has been organizing around this issue since it was founded in the mid-1990s. Battered women in prison or survivors were really central to the formation of the California Coalition for Women Prisoners, central to the building of a women's prison movement in California, and central to the building of prison abolition in California at large. Again, the fact that prisons and policing cannot provide safety or relief from gender-based violence because they produce gendered violence and exacerbate the harms people have already survived really, to me, tells us that abolishing prisons is a requirement for gender justice and safety. And yeah, I think part of the project, the part of this article was trying to show how incarcerated survivors and their own kind of self-organization is really central to whatever anti-prison movement, whether that's a women's prison movement in California, a prison abolitionist movement in California, they're really central to that story. And that's true across the country. I mean, there are so many incredible organizing efforts, incredible political leaders who are incarcerated, formerly incarcerated, who are really leading this work against the prison and policing systems.
Rachel Leah Klein, PhD candidate at USC in the Department of American Studies and Ethnicity. We've put a link again to her website and to the article, the open access article she wrote for the journal Gender and History, called Surviving Domestic and State Violence, Women's Prison Organizing and the Gendered Politics of Solidarity. That's on againstofthegrain.org. Rachel, thank you very much for your work and for joining us today.
Thank you so much, CS. I really appreciate being on here and having this conversation with you.
And that program was recorded on July 25th, 2024. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.